Welcome to this special spotlight edition of Label Sessions Presents. As part of our ongoing series exploring the new accelerators launching at Label Sessions, we're speaking behind the experts behind them. So today's conversation is all about, you know, the crossroads of emerging technology and well-being. And guiding us through it all is Lucia Komorjian, and a strategist who brings together ethical foresight, human-centered thinking, and a sharp understanding of how AI and tech innovation shapes society. Lucia's work has spanned roles at Telefonica, award-winning creative agencies, and collaborations with human rights organizations. She's known for helping businesses see what's coming and build tech that puts people first. So Lucia, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How are things going? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, good. And we've also got Nick here too. Nick is MD at Label Sessions, and also knows a lot about kind of what's going through with the accelerators. So hello, Nick.
Hello. Hi. Good to be starting to bring this into the world, this one. It's good to share more about it.
Wonderful. So Lucia, kind of, you know, what's new in your world? What's kind of exciting and what's going on?
In my very specific world, what is new and exciting is that I, for the first time as a strategist, I've actually made something and put it out into the world, and I've just run my first pilot with it. So that's it's obviously it's a blip in the real world, but it's a very big thing in my world. The pilot was for my media rehab program, which I've kind of brought to life as a as an online course so you can take in 21 across 21 days. Yeah, just took my first cohort through it, and was very humbled as well as very excited by its impact. And obviously there's like 1,000 things that I want to do to the next iteration now, in hope to run it again as soon as possible. So that's what's going on in my world at the moment.
Yeah, incredible. And I guess what originally pulled you into this space?
Into media rehab specifically, it's kind of been 10 years in the making. And I suppose it started exactly where all my work on digital well-being over this last decade started as well. And that was as part of a like discovery project when I was working for Telefonica in the innovation department. I was tasked to figure out, you know, what is the future of connectivity? Like what happens post 5G in the next sort of 5 to 10 years? And so back in 2015, when I started working on this project, I went to South Korea because South Korea at the time had the fastest, most powerful, both mobile and broadband networks in the world. So I was curious to see, you know, what is life like when it's powered by that kind of connectivity. And I went, I suppose, with a degree of naivety, thinking, okay, I'm going to come back with like all these crazy opportunities to share with the business in terms of like all these things you can do when this is what's available to you. And what I actually came back with was, yeah, cool, people can watch, you know, baseball games in HD, like a kilometer underground on the metro, great. But they're also wearing phone rings because there's like, you know, physical exhaustion from all this abundance of stuff they now have access to wherever they are. There are clinics for teenagers and children that are either addicted to gaming and social media. And there's also what I thought was really fascinating. There was some like colloquial language that people were using as a way of shaming others who were immersed in their screens. So it really was, a visceral experience of, you know, what then ended up being like the sort of core tenet of my entire practice since, a visceral experience of the duality of all technologies. And then following that exploration, we then ran some experiments as part of the same research project. We ran some experiments across multiple European markets where we just put young adults into two different groups. One group was given a sort of a surplus of connectivity. The other group was completely deprived of all forms of connectivity. And we hypothesized that the group that we sort of overstimulated with all this additional, you know, unlimited connectivity, and we like bought loads of apps for them that we uploaded onto their phones, we anticipated that they would be these, you know, like super enriched, super productive, super humans by the end of the week of our experiment, now that they've been given, you know, or that their access has been supercharged, and that the other group would just kind of like fall behind, be really bored, potentially also just sort of struggle to kind of get on with life. And what we found was the complete opposite. Those who were experiencing surplus were knackered and overwhelmed by the end of the week, and those that were deprived were initially like quite angry, and like it was quite hard for them to sort of deal with this new reality of not being able to have any kind of connection to anything, until they realized like actually connection to the outside, connection to using their cognitive functions and connection to friends and family, young adults, some of them were still living at home, spent more time with their family as a consequence of not being able to sort of like cocoon with Netflix in their room. And that, I think, the combination of experiencing that in the field as part of that study, and then coming back to the business and going, yeah, I'm really sorry, but I can't, you know, just stand here and give you, look at all these amazing, you know, I can't just stand here and communicate all these opportunities to you. I have to do due diligence on this and present the tensions that have been arising, very invisible still, I think, in our markets at the time, given this is 2015, but the tensions that will continue to build. And so that was, I suppose, my first taste of it. And that sort of from there on out, around any technology I explored, starting with this understanding of, you know, inherent dualities in all technologies, and looking at both positive as well as negative impacts that they are starting to have or could potentially have in people's lives, was like the heart of all my work ever since.
No, I feel that's super interesting. I know, like, we've spent the past, you know, decade or so designing for scale, speed, kind of stickiness. And now the challenge is to design for kind of, you know, the humanities, the kind of sanity and impact side of it. So, you know, I'd love to talk about, you know, the accelerator kind of tech for well-being, and about kind of, you know, rebalancing our relationship with technology as well. So I wonder, for you, why does this moment feel, you know, right for this kind of program? Like, why now?
I think that we're moving past just sort of academia and some pockets of industries being aware and also interested, not just interested in what's happening, but also interested in how to potentially address it, and into a phase where culture is starting to drive consumer demand and vice versa. And there has been, you know, there have been, like, if you think about specifically now on like smartphone usage, we've had these apps that have blocked other apps, like they've been around for, I would say they started probably to emerge around about like 2016, 2017. And it's still for a really, really long time felt like a really niche thing. And you were, you know, of a certain type that would gravitate towards something like that. And now there's like a pretty impressive industry has grown around, you know, call it anti-tech, call it, this isn't my word, it's a bit corny, but it's interesting nonetheless, you know, again, kind of demonstrating cultural appetite for it, abstinence, abstinence. It feels now also that what was previously a sort of a privilege to disconnect or to address your relationship with technology is something that's much more accessible and also desirable by people. interestingly enough, like one cultural development that, like, I'm not so sure how I feel about it yet, but I suppose if it encourages more people to sort of get with the program, I might be okay with it. There are some whispers of like disconnecting, getting off certain platforms, you know, abandoning tech, adopting a sort of Luddite mindset. That's starting to be seen as like a status symbol as well, which again, I'm kind of like, why should it be a luxury? It should be accessible for everyone. But nonetheless, like if it then, if at least in the sort of, you know, cultural realm encourages others to aspire, which, you know, status symbols tend to do, in that instance, I'm like, okay, I think I might be able to get comfortable with that. But yeah, I think the big change really has been culture driving consumer demand. Just yesterday, actually, I was at an event, albeit virtually, by an immersive theater production company called Sage and Jester, who are not only from next, or I think first week of June onwards, running an immersive theater experience around this theme of misinformation here in London. Over this last week, they've been, they hosted a series of events that are, you know, addressing certain issues around our relationship with tech. And while they're still like, they're in smaller theaters in London, it's still, it's culture, right? Like it's culture is out there sort of driving the conversation. And also in a language, obviously, that is far more accessible than an academic paper might be. Obviously, I mean, we started talking about this a few weeks ago, adolescence being a sort of a proper cultural highlight, really, driving at least a peak of awareness around specific type of media usage and teens and smartphone and their relationships to smartphones. So, yeah, that's what's different now. That's what's also, I think, driving urgency much more than we've seen before.
It's almost like there's a bunch of dots that are joining that wouldn't normally join, I think, because there has been, like you say, this really interesting period of research around the risks and the tensions that are coming from the way people are interacting with technology. But also, I think, just intuitively, people feel it a lot more. And I think actually, and I think also, interestingly as well, I think a lot of the people that lead digital or marketing are kind of, by their nature, kind of in the early adopter group of lots of kind of digital culture, which therefore means that that's a group in particular that kind of personally are kind of expressing, well, I think that everyone's just tried to in some way change their relationship to them, because to these things, because they kind of realize that the mobile phone app culture was having a negative effect on them in some way. So there's an interesting connection point. And then I think the other thing as well, from a more business standpoint as well, is also that we're in a kind of moment when in every sector we speak to, everyone is talking about well-being in the round as a thing that they want to offer to make part of their proposition. But I don't think they necessarily have the tools to actually think about that in a digital context. We kind of think about it in other contexts. And actually, to some level, are even more comfortable talking about things like sleep than they are talking about things like digital well-being in the round. But that's also, I think the challenges are quite fundamental, right? The whole way most of us were trained or kind of had entry into building digital products was built off things like the Hook canvas, which nobody ever really questioned as to whether hooking people was a thing you actually wanted to do. But it's kind of quite hardwired, I think, in the culture of digital product design and the whole way we think about those things, that's really focused on engagement is good, the more engagement the better, let's keep notifying people as much as possible, you've kind of done a good job, the more screen time you have. So it's really fundamental to start unpacking that, I think.
Completely. And at the same time, I think also really exciting, like who's going to be the first one to pioneer like breaking the mold, you know, who's going to be the first, or what company is going to be the first company that goes, actually, our metrics are going to be based on, like, you know, the faster you get off, the better kind of thing. And yeah, I mean, look, what you're describing, like a friend of mine reminded me again the other day of something the Anthropic CEO, Dario Amodei, said at some point last year, where he started talking about, where he wanted to position Anthropic as the company that is now pursuing the race to the top. And it's like, it's fairly idealistic, which I obviously quite like, given this is my state of the world that I inhabit, that if you, you know, have the courage to be the first that goes, we're going to do this ethically and responsibly and in a way that, and in their case, you know, very specifically, that also involves people, part of shaping their models, that involved looking to like the Declaration of Human Rights as some input and so on. Like pioneering that kind of a mindset as a company, particularly once then, you know, you're sort of, you know, the eyes of both the market and the consumers are on you and are on the rest of the market, like that, the overspill then into other businesses. Like, how are you going to not, you know, how are you going to keep doing the opposite if someone is out there very visibly doing it differently and ultimately also doing it better for the ecosystem and for consumers? So this idea of race to the top, I think, is it is ripe for the taking across all aspects of, you know, what sort of constitutes our digital lives, whether that's our connectivity, whether that's our devices, whether that's the platforms that we use, whether that's the utilities that we use, and ultimately, critically also, as you both know from my own research, media, how media behaves.
And I guess maybe one thing we should just flag as well, I think there's a massive opportunity for brands that want to be get into the race to the top. There is also, I think, dawning realization from a lot of people that there's actually a real risk that they are held more accountable than they currently are around some of the negative sides. Because all of this, in terms of, there's the cultural thing that people are aware of, the intuitive thing that people are aware of, but there's also the body of research, and it's also incredibly trackable. Yes. Like, there's not going to be much. I've had this conversation a few times. People are realizing, you know, stepping out of their kind of job role and talking about the organization and say it's going to be very hard in certain instances for us to say that we didn't know that some of these products were having a negative impact. We literally track every aspect. We can see it happening in real time. So I think there's an interesting moment there, a huge opportunity in the race to the top, but also a genuine need to, you know, in a business terms, manage the risk, which is that there's really hard research to show that some of the ways in which our digital services are behaving are creating, you know, bad health, right? We're actually making customers unhealthy. And the lesson of history is that at some point someone says, I want you to be accountable for that.
Yeah. Or, you know, as we've been seeing quite a lot, specifically from the Meta camp, whistleblowers will write books and then, you know, that then sort of like make their way into the cultural discourse. And you have that whole problem to deal with over and above research coming to light, or, you know, regulators also catching up and holding you accountable at a moment in time then when, you know, a sort of quasi-legacy system needs to be taken apart, which is obviously much, much harder and more expensive to do than if you were to, you know, address these issues much earlier before these systems become too reified.
Mm-hmm. I quite like the comparison to legacy systems, actually. I've not heard that phrase, because it is, I also think it's interesting where most of these things are negative outcomes that were sort of hardwired into the way the product was designed, but weren't ever intended. As well as there's interesting things, it's just like a lot of assumptions have led into you and said you're incentivizing teams to behave in bad ways. Yes. Whilst your leaders might not be wanting it to happen. They've kind of built the machine that produces that outcome. It's very like legacy systems in tech, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess part of those legacy systems are, to your point, like literacy as well as mindsets of teams that are, you know, part and parcel of creating and maintaining these legacy systems as mm-hmm. well. So there is, I think, over and above this being about an innovation drive, there's a huge education drive as well. Like most of the, most of my responsibilities, particularly around these big exploratory projects that I would like get to go off and do while I was at Telefonica, I would get measured on like soft power impact. You know, like you take this thing around the business across the world to all the operating businesses to just get people to, you know, your kind of extended colleague base to just like for 1 or 2 hours, stop thinking about your spreadsheet tracking your results for the end of this quarter and just like put your head above the parapet and let me take you on a journey of like past, present and future of the sort of the good, bad and the ugly around, you know, whatever theme it was that you were that everyone was either working on or that the company was prioritizing. And so I think that storytelling to educate, but also obviously like using tools like workshops as ways of also embedding that knowledge. And really, like, I think particularly workshops are great at kind of going with this approach, like how does this work to your specific area, internal venture arm, marketing arm, big data arm, you know, that is, that's a really, really important part, I think, of a wider rewiring or a wider rethink of a system, regardless of how old it is, towards, I guess, this notion of creating a more digital well-being friendly version of what it is that you're doing.
No, 100%. And I think that kind of what at least I'm picking up from this conversation is it's not just, you know, the just leadership or just the product team that needs to kind of jump on this, but it's all different leaders in within an organization. It's all really about that culture change. Yes. And making that happen. And you mentioned a few things about kind of practical shifts organizations can do or, you know, need to make. But where do you see that coming from? Is that kind of a leadership thing and bring that from the top, or something that starts from the bottom and has to kind of permeate through? What are your thoughts on that?
I think in my case, it was... I'm not going to claim that I was like, you know, sort of a grassroots activist in the business that I was in or in the businesses that I've been in. But if you, I suppose, you know, I wasn't part of the XCOM. I wasn't part of the like the top leadership team. But within, I suppose, the means that I had and within where I sat, I had, I had an ear. And I think the quality of the work in tandem with also like the novelty of this kind of work made sure that those ears were always open, if that makes sense. So if you will, like in the model at least that I've experienced is this sort of stuff tends to develop or this stuff will tend to emerge. From those who are, you know, at the coalface, if you will, or who are at least like, who have a really good sense of what's going on. It's unlikely to emerge in the sort of like bubbly nature of, you know, highest ranking leadership. But what then obviously is really important, and this is where I think like a big, big part of my work, which I guess I sort of just insinuated with a soft power comment was, how do you make these types of ideas palatable for people that probably really don't want to hear about it? The reason they don't want to hear about it is because when they hear about it, they're going to be like, oh my God, my share price, you know? So how do you develop like the storytelling tactics and the approaches that ensure, you know, that one ear becomes 10 ears, ultimately becomes, particularly in a very traditional hierarchical organization, becomes an open ear at the very top. And so once that's sort of like the first phase, if you will, and then in order for everyone else to sort of, I suppose, appreciate, but also feel that there is legitimacy behind these new ideas, then of course it has to come from the top. And that model worked quite well over the 8 years. I started doing this type of work really early. Like I started, like I said, back in 2015. And there was data. There wasn't just qualitative, but there was also quantitative data, as well as a whole bunch of other inputs, you know, from the sort of like strategic insight mining process. And that made the case really watertight. And that allowed for that type of bridge to be built to, particularly to audiences, very, very senior leadership audiences that, you know, they like numbers, and they also, there's a certain Yeah, there is a certain type of language that is required in order to get through. And a lot of that, the third pillar then is also relationship building, like kind of coming to something cold or bringing them into something cold. Who are you? You know, why are you not speaking Spanish? Like it was never going to work. It was relationships that had to then be built over time. And it took a while, but over time, you then also started to see, you know, the language around how we talk about innovation started to change. More and more initiatives around digital well-being started to develop, both for staff, but also for customers. While it was never perfect, it was still, you know, I'm sure a lot of other people who worked in massive, massive global conglomerates will understand, like, we always sort of use the oil tanker analysis where you're like, if you can just get it to move a little bit, you've done a good job, you know? So in a very long-winded way to answer your question, it's sort of like start here, get to there in order for it to get to there again, if that makes sense, and then kind of spread out. But that's just a model, obviously, of a massive, massive company. In a startup, it was a completely different story. It was like, get up at lunchtime one time, you know, show a presentation about an idea. You can be a little bit punchier. You can be a bit sharper. Dialogue ensues with the entire company rather than it sort of starting small and fanning out. Again, the setup depends, but having that ultimate endorsement from leadership is crucial in any setup, big or small.
I think as well, there's different starting points there maybe for this accelerator in practice as well, which is an interesting thing. So I think there are people who, they're running a futures function or they're explicitly focused on research. You therefore, I think there's an interesting moment now to articulate what the vision for the business needs to be around digital well-being and talk about what these questions are, both from a kind of high level opportunity space we've talked about before, also from a risk perspective. So there's people who can start out from that standpoint. On the flip side, I also know there's lots of leaders who are, you know, leading one product function or designing on around a particular target audience who will want to be the people who can take advantage of this opportunity right now and think through this new area, given everything we know. I think one of the things that would be really powerful through the accelerator, as we're talking about there, was to give the kind of give the data for why doing the right thing is the right thing to do all round. But fundamentally, and some of that will be like, I think there are really fundamental things to rethink through all of that. Although it fundamentally comes back to your relationship to customers and in general. Yeah. Like customers thinking you're a healthy thing that they trust and respect and want to have as part of their life has a good business case to it. It's just that lots of our behaviors have led it to be that we're in a space currently where it's quite a difficult conversation to have. I think quite soon you can see how it becomes certainly a really important conversation to have and almost one which I think, you know, on a kind of board shareholder level, people are going to be starting to turn around relatively quickly and say, what do we think about this? What is our view on this? How have we shown that we've responded to the data that's in the world, the regulation that's coming? How can we get ready for that?
Yeah, totally. And also, I think a really big part of that has to be not just listening to your customers, but involving them in the process, right? Involving them in, like, I've always been a big fan of co-creation, even if whatever the sort of output of a co-creation process is just like, it's an artifact that ends up being like a proxy for deep held needs. You'll probably make something completely different, but it's still just like this treasure trove of signals telling you like, okay, this is, you know, the type of experience that a customer will value. That's a really important part of it. And also I think in addition to that, keeping an open mind that, you know, don't go into this process thinking, okay, what tech am I going to make to like solve all the problems that my other tech has created. Yes, inevitably, I think there will be, an audit of features. There might also be a digital experience at the end of this, but thinking about, you know, what is your contribution to culture? What is your contribution to the debate that's kind of panning out in culture? What idea are you going to contribute to culture that people are going to see and go, oh, that's interesting. I might, you know, that's a new way of thinking about it. That's a a new thing to try or whatever. And how do you make that as compelling as possible? I think that whole area is completely untapped when you look at the sort of the corporate landscape. Start with a cultural idea and then figure out how to facilitate it later in other ways through an ecosystem of other experiences. That's I find that model very compelling.
Wonderful. Well, I guess on that note, Lucia, Nick, thank you so much for kind of sharing your insights and having this kind of wonderful conversation. I think it's super clear that the future is not something that, you know, just happens to us. It's something that we, you know, actively design, you know, through, yes, our decisions and our priorities and the culture as well. So yeah, if anyone that is listening is thinking about ensuring kind of, you know, your next innovation doesn't leave human needs behind, or, you know, if anything that we discussed kind of piqued your interest, this is your chance to go a lot deeper. So you can connect with us at labelsessions.com or reach out to any of us on socials for more information about the kind of Tech for Wellbeing Accelerator and everything else that we're building. So again, Lucia, Nick, thank you so, so much.
Thank you for the bravery of embracing something. It makes me really happy that you're up for this. So thank you for that.